So tonight's talk is about original nature. The mind had a conversation with itself about an hour ago. It went like this, very brief. Paul, you've been building up tonight's talk. You've been talking about it a little in the small groups and even in the big group. It better be good. I always liked the meal periods, so I didn't have to feel my painful knees. And I always liked the Dharma talks, because I didn't have to pay so much attention to myself. Chairs weren't around when I started in this, but if they had been, I would have headed for one quick. Anything to get off the floor, anything to get away from my knees. This inquiry into the structure of existence is no joke. It's intensive. It's direct, it's immediate, it's real, powerful, unsettling, and ultimately liberating. And there's no way around the facts. Many years ago, my wife and I went for some couples therapy. And I realized, not too long into the therapy, that I was the problem. It appeared to me that they both clearly knew it. And they had sided up with each other. I was convinced that this is what was going on, although nothing was being said about it. But I trust my intuition, I say. It energetically feels aligned over there. They're against me. The line that the therapist offered that was most significant, and it was for me, although maybe all of us, maybe himself as well, I remember it very well to this day. He said, the facts are friendly. And it resonated as a statement I'd never quite heard before. And I didn't completely get what he was saying, I thought, but I got something. And then I got something more, and then I got something more, and then I got something more. The echo effect resonated in, the facts are friendly. How about a statement that might be pretty close to that, but slightly different words? Reality is on your side. Doesn't always feel that way, though, does it? Our feelings and our perception about our feelings, how we view our feelings, even just in a little over a day of meditating together, can get quite turned, quite altered, quite askewed. One thing I can say for certain, waking up is never what the mind thinks it's going to be like. I used to think that if I could get my painful knees to go away, I'd be much better off. And then I believed I was when my painful knees finally went away. But then the pain moved to another part of the body. And then it moved to another part of the body, another part of the body, another part of the body, another part of the body. And a good Dharma friend, meditator, co-meditator, said, Paul, if you get it all smoothed out, you know where it goes next? The end of your big toe. I didn't believe him. I still believe that if I got the whole thing smoothed out, that if this whole thing was tension-free, I would be free. I will be free when there's no more tension. Convinced of it. And then the no more tense body appeared. And I, however I perceived myself, was fundamentally disappointed because all that was a pleasant body feeling that came and went beyond control. And then I felt, you know what, at least I didn't do what one of my teachers did. About 30 years ago, I got to spend some very intimate time studying with Joseph Goldstein, one of the first Americans to go over to Asia and bring the insight meditation practice, Vipassana practice, back to America. And Joseph, quite ardent, quite committed, was practicing in India. And he got into this, what he called the full body luminous tingle state, where everything was just completely tingling. And it went on, and it went on, and it went on, and it went on. And then as he shared the story, he got what's called the Quit India Notice, which is when they decide, for whatever reason, it could be visa related or otherwise, that it's time for you to go. So he got the Quit India Notice, and he headed back to New England, where he lived, fully expecting that he was going to drop right back, when he got off the plane, onto his meditation cushion, right back into his luminous, tingled body. And he got the polar opposite, aptly described as twisted steel. He said, my body felt like twisted steel. Now, here's the kicker, to me at least. He spent 2 years of practice actively trying to get back the luminous, tingle body. 2 years. I felt relief when I realized mine didn't take 2 years. Didn't even take 2 years to try to get the thing all smoothed out and soft and tension-free. And the relief kind of around the back door, because sometimes you hear about something that happened to somebody else, and strangely enough, your mind feels relief that it didn't happen so badly to you sometime in the past. Weird. Is that just my mind, or does your mind do that too? Okay, just checking. This could get really weird up here if I'm only talking about myself. Hey, it's weirder than that too, you know. I just came back from Hawaii. I have a friend out there that teaches Hawaii. Woo, yeah. People think it's all better out there. You know what? Human beings are waking up, and human beings are suffering everywhere. It doesn't depend on the beach. So my friend tells me, hey, Paul, want to hear about a workshop? And I said, yeah, what about it? He said, well, there was this workshop going on, and we didn't actually attend. We just went to the opening night talk, and then we bailed out. And the woman's method was, two things. Drink water and focus on me. Drink water and focus on me. Drink water and focus on me. So whatever else they were doing, she kept saying it. Drink water and focus on me. I said, why didn't she go to the whole workshop? You know what he said? Because I didn't want to focus on her. Can you imagine that? Drink water and focus on me. If you really want to realize what or who you are, what this life really is, then how about sit down and observe? How about sit down and take a good, honest, steady look? The Buddha said some cool things. Here's another one. whatever one frequently thinks about or ponders upon, that will become the inclination of the mind. Have you noticed what your mind tends to think about or ponder upon most? Interesting consideration. Let's just say a mind thinks about or ponders upon freedom or liberation most. According to this statement, then, that becomes the inclination of the mind. Let's imagine the thoughts mostly ponder upon, think about what doesn't seem okay, what doesn't seem right, what hurts, what feels inadequate, what feels uncertain. The statement suggests that becomes the inclination of the mind. If we truly want to realize who or what we are, we can sit down and take a good look. And if we sit down and we take a good look, I think quite inevitably, we're going to become engaged at some point or other with questions that come from the depth. And let's look at a few of these questions that come from the depth. What is death? What is death? Who dies? And what, if anything, doesn't? And along with that, how to relate, to consider, to reflect, perhaps even practice the Buddha's teachings on the deathless, what he called the unborn, the unconditioned. If you want to read about the deathless, the unborn, the unconditioned, guess what? You can close your eyes, sit in front of the computer screen, and if you know where the keys are, you can type out the deathless into Google, and you'll get a of stuff that comes back when you hit enter. Some of it's not going to be all that clear. Okay, that's the internet. So you might want to put the deathless, the unborn, the unconditioned. Whenever I don't know how to find something on the internet, I call up my son and I ask him how to find it. And being more computer illiterate than I am, he simply types in the words that I say to him into the taskbar or the Google box, and he goes there, and he walks away. Or he just texts it to me. Simple little things like, don't you remember what I told you last time? See, I can't yet say to him, part of enlightenment or being awake is recognizing the freedom to be ignorant. So bear with me, because that wouldn't, he wouldn't. Well, I don't know what he'd do with that. I'm going to skip it, though. Next. Oh, by the way, somebody told me the other day that they're convinced that the so-called two biggest fears for humans, fear of dying and the fear of public speaking, that the debate between which one's in first place had been resolved. And in her view, public speaking wins. And I contemplated that. Public speaking wins over death. Have you done a cross-cultural study? Have you really looked globally on this one? Or are you just kind of working with your own perceptions and feelings and maybe a few friends? Well, for some human beings, not all of us in this room, certainly, I imagine, the I is being tortured in the experience of fear, facing itself in front of other human beings when it's trying to publicly speak. And it actually believes, or thinks, or is convinced, or has faith, that it is going to be okay when death happens. Or maybe, watch this one, it's convinced that it will dissolve at death, and it feels relieved in having that thought because it hasn't figured out how to dissolve yet when it's up in front of people. And so it's nervous. Got a little excited there, didn't I? Question number one is tied to question number two. Question number two, what is liberation? What is it? And what or who gets liberated? Decent question. Number three, is it possible to live an unfragmented life? Is that possible? I'm not having fun doing this with folks like you, and by the way, I couldn't do this without you. Couldn't have this fun without you. It's fun to sit around and meditate. It's much more fun to sit around and meditate with you. I mean it. That same guy I was mentioning with the luminous tingle, Joseph Goldstein, when he started to meditate, okay, he wasn't a teacher yet. And when he first came back from Asia, having had a little taste of the meditation and tried to meditate in his cottage up in Vermont, he had all the little things. He even had, like, I think he had a bell for himself, and he had the incense sticks, and the mala beads, and the this and the that. Then he sat down, and he went to observe himself, and he realized he had no idea how to do it, that he actually needed a teacher. So when he got some teachings, then he started to sit, and he invited his friends over, and unlike the woman in Hawaii who said, drink water and look at me, he sat there with his eyes closed and hoped his friends would come over and look at him while he meditated. And he admitted it to us. Anyways, one of the things that I do for fun, and it is fun, and it's a labor of love too, and sometimes I definitely get very tired, is to do psychotherapy with folks. Because in order to live an unfragmented life, some human beings would not be able to discover that unfragmentedness just by meditating. One such person who I've been working with, she's been working with me, really, working me over. Really smart, love her. A few years into this now, she sends the email. It's called Awake Dream. Catch this. I had a dream, but I was awake. And I saw myself. I see myself. I am half full with a terrible, violent anger and half full with love, and I am restrained by thick, heavy chains clamped with iron bands around my wrists, just long enough that I can stand but no more, and I am screaming and screaming and screaming. The scene is as real as if I've stepped outside and performed it, and it feels entirely accurate. What do I do? What can I do to help? Response. For now, just see it. Sounds like the retreat. A powerful, seemingly real dream that depicts the trapped love in your heart held as yet by the chains of anger and hatred. It is a battle, no doubt, that all I can say, you can come to trust that only love can win in due time. It's a courageous, courageous, ongoing act of love. to see the forms of fragmentation, to see the forms of woundedness, to admit them at least at first, at least to yourself. If you can't, to yourself, maybe someone who you trust just enough can see something that you can't let yourself see. I don't mean a psychic necessarily, but someone who you trust enough can see something that you can't quite see and can mirror that to you. Like the therapist who said, trust, or what do you say? The facts are friendly. Question 4 ties to question 3, ties to question 2, ties to question 1. Question 4, how to live in love fully? Since we're going to live this life, is it possible to live it fully? And what are your models for living fully? Or loving fully? The Persian mystic, don't know his name. He said, the path of love and the path of insight lead into the same garden. That's what you begin to see, is that this path of insight is the path of love. This path of insight is the path of devotion. The path of devotion is the path of insight. Awareness is sublimely and subtly loving everything, because it's allowing everything. Interesting. Awareness is allowing everything. Everything appears that is seen has already been allowed by the awareness that sees it. That's why many people nowadays are teaching more and more about this awareness and using the terminology unconditioned awareness. The Tibetans years ago called it naked awareness. Sometimes it's called open awareness. I use the word choiceless awareness today. Question 5. Why? Why is there suffering? And what, if anything, can be done about it? And a sub-question inside there, maybe a very easy one for some of us. Just because there's physical, emotional, mental unpleasantness, let's call it pain, that's a concept, but let's call it that. Just because there are these things in the mind-body, must there be suffering? Then the 6th kind of opens us out a little bit to our connectedness globally. What about justice? What about dignity? What about respect? What about the fact that more people on planet Earth today do not have enough to eat than those who do? What about the justice, the respect, the dignity that we're granting ourselves and each other in a way by having the privilege to do this for a weekend? What about the contracted, ongoing mistreatments in all their different forms on planet Earth? What does this that we're sharing have to do with that? So maybe you get interested in any or all of these questions. And once you get interested in any or all of these questions, and maybe you have some others, once that interest is engaged, the seeker is definitely mobilized. With this mobilization of seeking, there is a definitive feeling or perception that something is missing, or something is incomplete, or something is not quite right. with oneself, with the world, with life. Something's not as one at least imagines it could be. This dissatisfaction, or you could call it disquiet, can be very subtle and in many cases overlooked. And one could actually appear to others to be quite happy, quite content, quite at peace, and yet beneath the surface, beneath the persona, this subtle or not so subtle dissatisfaction or disquiet rumbles, easily overlooked, easily ignored in some cases. In other cases, it's right in your face. And some are sensitized to this disquiet, this dissatisfaction. They're sensitized to it from birth. They're sensitized to it from trauma. They're sensitized to it by loss. They're sensitized to it by noticing that what is wanted doesn't always happen. And what is unwanted, more often than one would perhaps like to admit, happens. Or the calling, and it's a calling, yes, not a phone call, but a calling of a spiritual text, a teaching, or the presence of one who has in some way awakened. Make no mistake, it could be your cat, your dog, a bird. It doesn't have to be a human being awakened. It could be a tree. I like how the word dharma, the truth of the way things are, also means the nature, the natural world. I like that. But regardless of how it happens, or even why, that dissatisfaction, that disquiet, that dis-ease creates a turning. It creates a turning. In the Tibetan tradition, they call it the turning of the mind. It could be perceived or it could be depicted as that first turning into what? Don't know yet, but turning beyond conditioning. Turning towards something that in some way, hopefully, will be a response or an answer to the dissatisfaction, the disquiet. Do you remember when that happened? Because I can pretty well assure that that's happened to every human being in this room. Not necessarily consciously. Doesn't have to be conscious. An interest arises to go beyond the surface of things. Interesting. Interesting that this happens. This happens for human beings. It is nothing short of a form of awakening. However, this looking, this turning, this, as it's sometimes described as repentance, you know what the real meaning of repentance means? It doesn't mean to repent to another human being who will grant you care, mercy, pardon, and then vow to not sin again. That is an adaptation and an aberration. The real meaning of the word repentance is to turn and look afresh. It has nothing to do with bad, it has nothing to do with being a sinner, it has nothing to do with you aren't okay, and it has nothing to do with guilt. It's simply a turning towards what perhaps one doesn't know, but it's an interest of turning in a new direction. However, this turning, this looking, in most cases is coming from a belief in an individual who is doing the turning, who is doing the looking, who is doing the about face. A belief that there actually is an individual inside these bodies. Behind the turning is this belief in a self or a me that is doing the turning, that is doing the looking. A belief there is definitely an individual me, and this individual me has free will, has choice, and is on a journey in time. It's a belief that can't be substantiated in direct experience. In other words, if investigated, where is the individual? Where is the self? Where is the me? When I say it can't be substantiated, what I'm saying is it can't be located. It can't be found. You can say, even though it's a concept, I found my knee, or it found me. That's called substantiation. It's a concept still, because if you go in and experience the knee directly, the concept of knee goes away, and this is vibration. This is tingling. This is heaviness. This is lightness. This is warmth, coolness. That's the direct experience of the thing we call knee, and that's true for the whole body. This body, when examined under the lens or the scope of meditation, reveals a field of energy, sensation. The concept of body is a thought. How about that? So this sense or belief, idea of an individual inside here can't be substantiated in direct experience. The actual me can never be found if looked for. It can't be found or pinned down because it doesn't actually exist except as a concept. So then, good question now I'd like to ask, what gets wounded? What gets wounded when one's parents don't get it right? And everybody's parents in this room did not get it right all of the time. They got it right some of the time, but not all the time. And sometimes, as you could imagine from the dream where she said, I was awake in the dream. Isn't that what she said? I don't have time to go into the layers of horror in the history of this young woman's past. The childhood, the abandonments, the isolation. What gets wounded? What gets wounded? The answer is clear. The body, mind gets wounded. The feelings get wounded. The thoughts get wounded. The body sensations get wounded. Where is the I that gets wounded? The I that gets wounded is the I that says, I am the body, I am the feelings, I am the thought, I am the perception. I am the desire, I am the fear, I am the pain. What gets wounded? In Buddhist psychology, it would be called the five aggregates: body, feeling, mental activity, perception, and consciousness. Interesting, consciousness. What consciousness? This consciousness I'm speaking of now is the knowing faculty. It's not the same as awareness. There's a consciousness that arises and passes. It's coming now if the ears go to the sound of the boat. A different consciousness arises when the smell of the food comes. A different consciousness arises when there's a feeling in the body as awareness of the breath. A different consciousness arises when there's a knowing of the thinking. That's all that consciousness does. And it's very subtle. That consciousness goes underground, you might say, when the more surface aggregates of body, feeling, perception, and thought get wounded. Regardless of how much of this so-called wounding happens to this body-mind process, for most human beings, when the turning, and sometimes it can take quite a lot of hardship to get some human beings to actually turn, if I could use a metaphorical statement, towards the light. And sometimes that turning towards the light, or an attempt to turn towards the light, is right into organized religion. Right into the sanctuary. Right into the AA group. But there's a belief that a journey is happening. And this journey has a purpose. And it's always a journey towards something. It's a something that's always obscure. It's always fanciful. And it's actually a mirage. Have you ever seen a mirage? A so-called real mirage? I use those words because the mind believes it's looking at something that's real. And then it gets closer, perhaps, and it realizes that's a mirage. That wasn't what I thought it was. You know, the old snake and rope thing, right? There's lots of those. It's incredibly significant, maybe the most important line in this whole talk. Maybe, I don't know, for you. Never know, for you, unless you tell me. You always can do. It's very important to see that the seeker never knows what in fact it's actually looking for. It has no idea. Except the mirage. The ongoing, permanent, luminous tingle of Joseph Goldstein, Paul's smooth, tensionless body, sustained forever. I mean, it can be as ridiculous and interesting as a chocolate cake. And that's the mirage. Life, at its best, is an enduring chocolate cake. That's it. Of course, it's a metaphor, right? Even though it's a literal thing, a chocolate cake is a literal thing that some of us like. It was always my favorite cake. I don't want vanilla chocolate. I want chocolate with chocolate ice cream. No raspberries, no strawberries. If I can get it. The story of me is in time, because time is thought. And when there is no thought, there is no time. The story of me, the story of self, is in time. A self or me that has experiences in sequence, That's also another aspect or dimension of time. Life is sequential. And it's always, again, can't emphasize it enough, it's always a journey towards something. Again, the funny thing is, what's the something? What's the something? The seeker has no idea. It's a belief in a story of a self or me that will someday be fulfilled. Let's try that one. It'll be fulfilled. It'll be happy. It's a me, it's a self, it's an I that will be released from suffering. One day I'll get there. I hope. And it's always yourself, myself, the self, that's the main character in the story. Other characters may be a part of that. You may weave them in at times, push them out at times. You're in my way, you're in my circle, you're part of my story. You can stay, you need to go. Around and around that one goes, how the I or self incorporates other I's or selves into its story of what it is that it's trying to do with itself to bring about what it thinks it's all about. And sometimes we're meek about it and we just kind of work it out with one other human being. You know, hammer away there. Let me get it straight with at least you. I have a friend that has a lot of deep wisdom. He's a little bit skitzy at times, in my view. Great teacher as well. Having said skitzy, now I can't name him. By the way, if you don't see yet, that anybody who does this stuff long enough has a guaranteed diagnostic category that anybody with their eyes open will see within about 10 seconds. Usually it's somewhere in the skitzy zone. He had a line, I loved it, he said to me, he said, if I knew myself clearly and distinctly in relationship with other human beings, I'd be free. See, he'd worked out a lot of stuff in his meditation by himself. Deep meditation, many years, practicing as a monk. I agreed with him 100% when I heard his Dharma talk. Loved his Dharma talk. His Dharma talk was off the chart, beautiful, loving. But then he went to answer questions. And the whole thing went sideways. And I felt like, I need to stop him now. He's offending people. He's upsetting them. He's agitating them. They're starting to hate him. Some people in the back row are starting to look violent. I need to get him to shut up. I need to get him out of here. I'm the sponsor of this talk. It all started to get very, 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 very bad. And it all got clarified when he said, if I knew myself in relationship, I'd be free. And I said, yes, you're right. And you don't know yourself in relationship at all. Okay. A lighter moment. Maybe. If the self is always the main character in the story, working towards what? Better places, maybe better possessions, maybe different possessions, maybe less possessions, maybe more, maybe shinier. People, or how about just shoot all the way? The self is working for liberation or enlightenment. Poet Rilke, I love Rilke, by some considered the greatest poet of our time, this time, the time we're in, these lives, alive, close to us. He said it like this, we are the driving ones. Ah, but the step of time, think of it as a dream in what forever remains. All that is hurrying soon will be over with. Only what lasts can bring us to the truth. Young men and women, don't put your trust in the trials of flight, into the hot and quick. All things already rest. darkness and morning light, flower and book. He's taken us a little beyond the belief in the I, me, individuality. But he's talking about the risks along the way. Here's the deep irony. The teachings are full of what appears to be paradoxical to the thinking mind, and what appears as ironic. The deep irony is that the story of me never really gets any better. It just seems to, as it goes up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down. It appears to improve, and then inevitably it declines again. And you can go and try to pump it up again, and you can only hold it for a while, and then it collapses again. It goes around and around and around because it is the nature of perpetual wandering. It is the nature of what the Buddha called samsara. And I'll just stick this in to kind of go with the poem a little bit. The sure heart's release, the sure heart's release happens as the I, me, mine belief structure is seen through. That's what releases the heart. So what do we human beings do with this apparent dilemma of a self, I, me, that's seeking fulfillment? Well, we pick up religion, as I already mentioned. We pick up different kinds of modern movements. We pick up different kinds of therapies. We join up with these. And in most cases, these therapies, these religions, these modern movements, they have one thing in common, and that is this. They try to make the story better. They try to make the story better. And what's that story? Let's get at it. They try to make the existential facts, facts are friendly, right? They try to make the existential facts of birth, aging, sickness, and death more comfortable. And sometimes they do it with absolute, total hearsay. And we're gullible, and we're suggestible. Here's two very important parts of the human right now. Everybody in this room wants to do what they want. That's why some of you, you don't have to tell me, are not following the meditation instructions. I know, I have psychic power, and I can see you. You're not doing what I'm saying, and it's okay. Okay? That's one truth. The other truth is, you're very suggestible. We're very suggestible, and we want to do what we want. Interesting combination. You know what some therapists have understood? They've understood that if you can figure out what a human being wants to do already, and it's a good thing, and you can support them in that by hypnotizing them, quote unquote, you can help them. Kinda. You can help them kinda feel a little more comfortable about birth, aging, sickness, and death. Because all you're really doing, in a way, is feng shuiing the furniture around to a little bit of a better position so that for a little while, you're like, oh, I'm better. I'm better. Right, I'm better until something happens and then I'm not. Every now and then you'll see somebody. It's not just because of the torque of the sensations. Don't open your eyes and do this, okay? Keep your eyes closed. Okay, sort of. But if you do open your eyes, you'll notice that some people are looking for God to the left, just over here. And other people, it's down here. I don't know what's down there, but something's down there. Might just be sleepiness. I'm going to suggest that's not just the torquing of the sensations that are produced by the impressions of past actions, that are produced by the volitional part of the mind, that produces actions, and sometimes those actions happen in a way, and I don't even know what I'm doing. The words are coming out of my mouth. Someone might be even upset by them. I haven't registered that yet. And as a very dear friend and client who now lives in Denver once said to me, Paul, it's not going that good. I said, what do you mean? She said, well, my past is catching up with me. And I said, what do you mean? She said, what, do I have to be like figurative? I mean, what do you need? It's simple, Paul. The 2x4 of life is hitting me. It's a 2x4. We went on to talk about it a little bit more. I'd like to suggest that that turning of this body, that turning of the head, the way this body is positioned in this sitting hall is not just because of the torquing of karma. It's because of the turning to the light. That's a suggestion. These movements, these therapies, in most cases, not all, but some, probably most. These religious activities, not all, but a lot. They try to make you more comfortable with the journey that you think you're on. And if enough people are together, whether they're drinking coffee and having pastries and chocolate cake or not, if they're comfortable believing this is what's going on, then we're even more comfortable because we have camaraderie and agreement. The Buddha said, awakening is like swimming against the current of modern culture, modern belief. He didn't really go over there and start poking around with the word religion. Because in his time, the religions on planet Earth weren't nearly as, you might say, prolific in their organized, indoctrinated forms that we now see them. You can look at history and find that out. It's right there. But I'm going to give it also a little turn. In some cases, religion and these modern movements, they even put off to point directly into the mystery of incarnation. And they try to offer support for the inquiry into the fundamental question, which I didn't ask. It ties all the others together, which is, who am I? If you don't like the who word, just put what. What am I? True spirituality and wisdom traditions and religion, when it works, as well as awake beings, then and now, they get to this question and they get to the answer. But as long as there's a belief, more or less a belief, that I am an individual, me, then everything else is experienced as subtly separate. Try that right now. See if you can just see, just for a second maybe, or the sense, not necessarily belief, but just something that says, you're inside the body. I'm inside this body. And then notice from that vantage point, so to speak, that everybody else in this room is subtly separate. See it? Now that can morph, shift, thin, and go away completely, and it does, all day and night long. It's an inconstant. But let's just say you're kind of comfortable in the body, the body's kind of comfortable. When you look into another human being's eyes, and that other human being is also comfortable, and you look into each other's eyes, and we've all done this to some extent, you don't have to feel like you love the person. You may never have met him before. You don't even have to like him. Just look into the eyes and look at that which is coming out of those eyes and begin to see that what's coming out of those eyes seems to be similar to, if not the same, as that which is coming out of your eyes. And then that sense of separation starts to soften and in some cases completely go away. Maybe just for an instant, maybe longer. But as long as there's a belief that I am an individual me, then everything else is experienced as subtly separate, not just other human beings. The whole so-called world. Physical world. I am something, and everything else is something else. And this brings a subtle dissatisfaction, subtle unfulfillment, and it's the sense of separation. And this is what drives all the seeking, all the searching, and ultimately all the suffering. That's it right there. And the biggest addiction at the root of all other addictions is the addiction to the story or belief that I am in here. Separate me or self. And the illusion that this self or me can reach or experience fulfillment. This game, and it is the game, it's some cases, it's realized as the only game in town, is at the center of all other games. What's actually going on is the other way around altogether. Fulfillment appears as the I or me that's seeking it dissolves. Fulfillment appears as the I or me that's seeking it dissolves. Quite interesting. This happens every night in deep sleep. All of what I'm describing is completely gone. Utterly gone in deep, deep dreamless sleep. There is no time, there is no story, there is no me, there is no suffering. But again, just to kind of give it its due share here, the subtle or not so subtle dissatisfaction born from the sense of separateness drives the sense of seeking, all the seeking, all the clinging, all the searching, all the attempts to not suffer. All the attempts to be free or liberated, all the attempts to be satisfied, whether it's inside or outside, it's all going around in circles. And even when there is a turning born from a consideration, maybe a burning consideration of one of the big questions, most of the time, the turning is towards someone or something out there or something in here to attempt to solve the problem of dissatisfaction. And the deep initial depression, for some it's only an instant, for others it's longer, is to realize the absolute futility of the method that's being engaged in. I am something unfulfilled. I am separate, therefore I must turn to something else to fulfill me. This is the existential, incarnational dilemma at the root of all psychological, religious, and spiritual seeking. And to nail it even more graphically, 13th century Indian mystic Kabir said it like this: If you don't break your ropes while you are alive, do you think ghosts will do it after? What is found now is found then. If you find nothing now, you will simply end up with an apartment in the city of death. He's not pulling any punches, is he? What can be quite disturbing at first and then ultimately wonderfully liberating is that the story of me, the story of I that is seeking fulfillment in time through experiences that seem to bring a sense of purpose or direction to life is in fact the root of the dissatisfaction itself. The story of individuality living inside this body, as necessary as it seems to live in this world, this culture, these relationships, to fulfill the spellbinding is an important word there, message of success that much of us have been indoctrinated into by modern education and our family of origin systems, turns out to be the rope. That's the rope. Apparently. Keyword. Another way to put it, this is the field of dreams. This is the field of sense contacts and sense pleasures. This is the field where the I or me or individual attempts to find the fulfillments. This is where the individuality tries to fulfill itself. It's the field of dreams. And I simply mean this by using the word dream, I mean that which comes and goes. Can you see the waking state coming and going? Go into deep sleep, the waking state's gone. Can you see the dream state? I'll bet she's happy that the dream state, at least for now, has passed. Those horrible chains on the body in the dream. You know those kind of dreams? Don't we call them nightmares, night terrors? Isn't it a relief, although sometimes just a little bit, that you go, whew, that was just a dream? This is a dream too. This is disturbing for the mind sometimes. What do you mean this is a dream? That's a dream. This is, whoa, 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 whoa. Don't you be taking away my reality? All I'm saying is this is a dream in that it comes and goes. Another image. How about we're in the birth canal of awakening? This body mind is in the birth canal of awakening. At one point it was in the birth canal of the mother. This body was in the birth canal. But don't remember it happened though, unless you came out C-section. Then you were in the womb. Everybody's in the womb. These bodies were in the womb. And the common phrase, the common statement is, I was born on such and such a day, and such and such an hour, and such a place. I was born. The idea of I was born and attached to the body. Do you know babies don't have that idea that I is born? There's a little baby that's coming with parents for therapy. It's quite a gift. They bring the baby in. And what I get to do while I do therapy with the parents is hold the baby. Bonus prize. I mean, I don't take the baby, but I wait until the mom's ready to give me the baby. Okay? Because the dad is too out of it. Okay? Too out of it in a certain sense, and in it in the right sense, to do his share. It's okay. He can slump on the couch. I'll hold the baby. I got the baby. I love this baby. And this baby is now starting to make contact. You know that look where it's kind of like misty, foggy, ethereal, not quite there? Well, 2 weeks ago, the little guy finds the fan in the ceiling. And now he's got the fan. It's almost like he's got the fan with one eye and me with the other. Okay, he's like, don't have a sense that there's a belief that I am an individual and I have to fulfill myself by looking at the fan or whatever. It comes later. In fact, science is starting to nail it down. They're starting to look at how the brain develops, and they're saying the concept of I, the concept of the self, the concept of the me, doesn't come until a little bit longer on in the developmental process, and they're starting to try to figure that out. Understand it, write about it. Okay. If we look closely, we can see that the sense of me, the sense of I, this so-called individuality or person, is actually an embodied, contracted sense of identification with a concept that, if not looked for within this body-mind, and if you look, you can't find it, if not looked for, it seems to almost neurologically inhabit this. And then it goes to, I am the body. And I'm not saying you're not the body. I'm just saying it's not all of you. Until that concept of I, the identifying with tendency, that's another way to talk about the I, the identifying with tendency. You know where clinging comes from? The perception, belief in an I. The I itself is clinging. Again, Buddha, very clear. What is the clinging towards? You see, because clinging doesn't just go off and cling like into vast space or the blue sky, usually, though it could. What does it do? It goes to sense pleasures. It goes to a perception of maintaining itself, that's called existence, or it goes to the clinging to what's called non-existence. You know what that means? It wants to die. And that's what's operating in the suicidal mind at times. It's not just wanting to kill the pain. It's wanting to kill the I that seems to be experiencing the pain. I'll shoot at that for what it's worth. That's Russian roulette. Tricky stuff. Very important, again, the sense of me or I is really not only inconstant, which means it arises and passes, but it's also inconsequential, ultimately. Because let's say there's an interest in fulfilling a, you could say, project. One of mine that might happen in this lifetime is to grow fruit trees. Thinking about it more than doing it, but we'll see. So it's an interest. Figuring out that if I talk about it more, it might reinforce the possibility. It's more belief system, right? I'll talk about it. I'll tell people. You know, I'll even tell them what I see and what it looks like, and I'll maybe draw it and I'll write it down. So far, nothing has happened, but we'll see. Actually, okay. It's imagination. If that is the interest, okay? Do you know how much easier and freer all of that is when there isn't an I or me or self that has to do it, who's either more or less satisfied or dissatisfied with the outcome of it, who's busy evaluating what happens and saying, I have to do more, I didn't do enough, I got to do that, I got to change this, how about that, they didn't like it, what about that, I need feedback. It goes on and on and on. And who are the human beings in the world who are, let's go with this world, word, the most balanced in your perception? Do you like the Dalai Lama? I do. Do you like Thich Nhat Hanh? I did walking meditation with Thich Nhat Hanh in Marin County, California at Spirit Rock. There was about 2,000 of us. It felt like Jesus was leading us. That was my imagination. Only thing is, he's wearing a gray robe and he's from Vietnam. It's all right with me. we're going out for the bread on the mountain. We're going to have the... It all sounded perfect in my mind. And I don't know whether I said it here, but the bright ones, the bright lights, we can't take it, you know? We can't take it. We snuff them out if we can. The Shams of Tabriz snuffed out. He wasn't snuffed out. The body was snuffed out. Can't snuff out the Shams, otherwise Rumi wouldn't have woken up and found the Shams as his true self in his own heart had never left him. The sense of me or I is really not only inconstant, but it's also fundamentally inconsequential. What becomes increasingly relevant is that which sees, that which rests as seeing, that which rests as awareness, that which abides in and through all that's happening, that which doesn't move, doesn't change. If there's a clear memory of what it was like when this body-mind was chronologically 5 years old, that which sees the memory is the same thing that sees this room right now. And this that is resting as awareness actually cannot be disturbed. It can't be fulfilled. Watch this. It can't be fulfilled because it's complete in itself already. And then it's clear that wanting and even getting experiences and things is never actually truly fulfilling. It's pseudo-fulfilling. Waking up appears as seeking dies. And it's impossible to want to stop seeking. Well, it's not impossible. You can want to stop seeking, it just won't stop the seeking. Because wanting to stop seeking is seeking the end of seeking. Sounds a little woo-hoo-hoo-hoo. So the Sufi says it like this. What we speak of cannot be found through seeking, but only seekers find it. When the seeking energy interfaces with the wonder of futility, the wonder of helplessness, the wonder of vulnerability, the wonder of there is no control, when the seeking interfaces with the wonder of futility, it's starved, and thus it can dissolve. And in some humans, the seeking is tenacious. It is supercharged. So it's very strange in a way that unknown to itself, the seeking energy, the wanting tendency, is trying to end itself. There's a little piece that works nicely on this one. You ever want something? Yeah? Can we go there for a sec? You ever want something? Okay. You ever get it? You ever get what you want? Do you ever experience the satisfaction, little or a lot, when you got what you wanted? Okay. Here's the truth. The reason why you feel happy, the reason why you feel satisfied to some extent, the reason why you feel relieved when you get what you want is not because you got what you want, it's because wanting went away. Check it out. What the seeking is looking for is actually hiding. Is already being everything. The seeking is looking, what it's looking for, is hiding as already being everything. Everything just as it is, for even just an instant, free from the conceptual overlay, the story of or belief in a separate, in volitional, don't forget that word, I or me, a conceptual overlay like a chunk of added software sitting on top of childlike wonder and innocence. And make no mistake, it sits on top. It's up here. That's why if you ever want to explore an interesting set of teachings, look at the teachings of Douglas Harding. He basically did some very interesting work, and one of his works is called The Experience of No Head. And it's a very interesting approach that he has to inquiry and basically taking apart the concept of the separate self or the individual. And he's got some interesting exercises that actually do produce some shifts, it seems, for some people.